Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It is Friday, March 11th, 2022. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me with his reporting and editorial analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So the Russian invasion of Ukraine has entered its third week, Andrew, and the publishing community continues to express its concerns.
Amazing. Yeah. And another chance for me to point out the work of my colleague Ed Nowacka in reporting on this incredible tragedy unfolding in Ukraine. You can check out Ed's reporting, which continues to be excellent on the PW site, including a current development, which is that the Conference of International Book Fair Directors, which, as you might imagine, as the name suggests, represents a wide swath of international book fairs and brings their leaders together. Well, they've issued an open letter condemning the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And the letter states that this assembly of book fair directors cannot remain either silent or indifferent to Russia's transformation of Ukraine into, and I'll quote them here, a killing field, and that they have therefore resolved to suspend contact with any Russian state institutions and agencies. And on the flip side, they've invited publishers and authors from Ukraine to exhibit at their fairs at no cost. The letter was signed by directors of a number of major international book fairs, including Bologna and Brussels, Frankfurt, of course, Warsaw, Prague, Guadalajara, Jerusalem, Gothenburg, Sao Paulo, Bogota, Taipei, Seoul, Leipzig, Budapest. The list goes on. You know, and I know it seems hard to think about how all this really matters much in the face of, you know, this ongoing vicious attack in Ukraine. We see the footage of it every single night on the news, but it really does matter, I think. And I think it's yet another sign of the world's solidarity in opposing Russia's aggression, and a crucial one, I think, given that, you know, information is a battlefield as well. In his report, Ed Nowacka, my colleague at PW, also runs down other developments, including an effort by the sort of Ukrainian Publishers Weekly. It's a website called Kitomo, which is it covers the books and media market, much like we do here at PW. It has launched an English language version of the site, launched last week, and it features several stories, including, for example, a list of books for, quote, urgent translation. There's some new poetry inspired by the war and also diary entries from within Ukraine. And also, we should note that there are members of the Ukraine publishing community that have put on uniforms and grabbed their guns and are serving as soldiers fighting the Russian invasion. And they've been posting about their experiences on social media. And Ed's taken a look at a few of those, including Vitaly and Dmitry Kopronov. I'm sure our listeners are keeping up with the events in the news from Ukraine, devastating as it is. But I think it's important, too, to note that the book community in Ukraine is doing all that it can. And we're doing all that we can, I think, in the book community around the world to try to support the effort, even if, you know, honestly, it doesn't feel like much, certainly not a no-fly zone, which would be useful to sort of, you know, end the tragedy that just keeps unfolding in Ukraine.
In Washington, members of the House Judiciary Committee have alerted the Justice Department to potentially criminal conduct by Amazon executives relating to a committee review of competition in digital markets. That investigation concluded in 2020, but this news is a potentially significant development.
Yes, I would think so. You know, the news this week being a letter to the DOJ from Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler, congressman from New York, that accuses Amazon of engaging in misleading behavior, of actually misleading the committee. It's a 24-page letter, stated March 9th. It accuses Amazon executives of lying, basically in sworn testimony to the committee in 2019, basically about whether Amazon uses data that it collects from third-party sellers to actually compete with them. The letter cites credible investigative reporting, as well as the committee's own probe, which found that the company was clearly engaging in the practice of using third-party data, despite its denial. And when confronted, lawmakers say that Amazon tried to cover up its lie by offering these sort of ever-shifting explanations of its policies and by, and I'll quote the letter here, stonewalling the committee. Now, what does this all mean for Amazon? What does it all mean for that report on competition in the digital markets? Honestly, I don't think it means much at the moment. For one, think it's fair to say that the DOJ under Merrick Garland hasn't exactly been quick to get off the mark with these kinds of criminal referrals. But more, it's not clear that this really does anything to sort of bolster the committee's findings or move Congress closer to action against Amazon. This is really about the alleged conduct of certain executives and not really about coming up with a plan of action or for, you know, acting on what the committee has already learned. And I'm not expecting that there's going to be any major actions or any criminal indictments against anyone at Amazon, at least not anytime soon. And this despite the committee's already reported findings in that report, which came out in October of 2019.
Barnes & Noble booksellers left the public market in 2019 to go private, and there hasn't been much to report on the business since then. However, PW has news this week that 2021 looks to have been a strong sales year for the chain.
Yeah, and how many times over the last decade have we spoken about Barnes & Noble in a negative context, right? Usually when their quarterly results came out, we'd always have something to say. Well, the company is now, it's a private company, and CEO James Daunt tells PW that, in fact, 2021 was a good year, was a very solid year. News that is sure to be good news for publishers, and also news that I don't think should be a surprise given the rising bookstore sales as the pandemic has relented from 2020 when so much retail was shuttered. We should also point out that because it is a private company, we no longer see Barnes & Noble's numbers. We just have to take their word for it. But according to CEO James Daunt, the numbers were pretty positive. Despite a slow December due to the Omicron surge, 2021 turned out to be another year of solid growth, Daunt said. He made these comments while on a national tour to meet with BNN store managers. Our listeners will remember that Daunt, with the financial backing of Elliott Advisors, took over Barnes & Noble as CEO in September of 2019. And he went on to tell PW that sales in the first 8 months of 2021 were running about 5 to 6% above 2019 levels, which is really strong growth for Barnes & Noble. And he also said that the numbers that were coming in for the later months, like November, for example, were also very strong. Now, a couple of things that I'd point out from this piece, which is on the PW website. Daunt said that sales at physical stores improved over 2020, which I think is to be expected, given the way the pandemic has sort of relented a bit. But online sales dipped as people started to go back to those stores. Now, notably, and here's what I think is worth pointing out, though online sales went up and then dipped, they didn't give back all the ground they earned over the past 2 years. And I think that's something to watch in the coming years. And by that, I mean, how much is consumer behavior modified by the pandemic? How much will those new consumer behaviors, such as buying books online, remain? So again, something I think that's worth paying attention to, how much Barnes & Noble is selling online, or even people who are reading ebooks or streaming digital audio. Another thing I think worth mentioning, backlist titles drove the overall sales increase at Barnes & Noble. And we've talked a lot about the performance of the backlist on this show over the last year or so. And Daunt's comments, I think, are more confirmation of the value of the backlist. And specifically, Daunt said that he can see those sales being sparked by social media, specifically BookTok, which, according to Daunt, is getting younger readers interested in books. And again, that's also really interesting because one of the questions that we raised throughout the pandemic is whether publishers' rising sales were coming from established readers buying more books or whether or not they were bringing in new readers. Well, this remark from Daunt suggests that they're seeing new readers. So you can check the article out on the Publishers Weekly site, and you can read more about how Daunt expects 2022 to shake out. And some interesting notes there, for example, you know, Daunt's strategy to give more local control over management of the stores has actually, he says, translated into, you know, better operations, more judicious orders, and lower returns. So that's one interesting note I think we should keep an eye on going forward. And I think, too, with the pandemic numbers going in the right direction, a return to in-person events at Barnes & Noble stores is also on the horizon. So a lot of good things upcoming, hopefully, if we can keep these pandemic numbers in shape. And I think there is a lot of hope that the nation's largest bookselling chain can also keep the good news coming in 2022.
The Texas Library Association, Andrew, has launched an organization to fight book bans in libraries and schools. The move comes as a response to efforts in that state to keep inappropriate books out of the hands of readers, especially young ones.
Yes. So I think this is interesting news. The Texas Library Association, which is a major library association, their annual conference is as large as almost anything that the ALA puts on these days. Well, they formed a grassroots coalition called Texans for the Right to Read, designed to amplify and unify the voices of librarians and educators, as well as parents, students, authors, and anyone else really who opposes these growing efforts to ban books from schools and libraries across the state of Texas. You know, and it's honestly, it's mind-bending to think about where we are right now, that this is where we are, but it really is our reality. You have to look at what's going on the ground in Texas, for example. Greg Abbott, the governor there, is pushing this parental bill of rights. He's publicly demanded that state agencies that oversee education and library funding do something to keep, quote, inappropriate books out of Texas schools. Inappropriate, of course, being a very subjective term. Abbott has specifically called out books involving LGBTQ themes, books that have been featured in complaints in other states, curiously enough. And Abbott's directive also follows this headline-grabbing inquiry our listeners may remember that was launched in October by a Texas state representative that included this list of more than 850 books that were singled out for scrutiny. And look, it's not just going on in Texas, right? It's, you know, in Florida, you have the Don't Say Gay bill, right? In Idaho, there was another similar parental bill of rights law, which would also call for the potential prosecution of persons alleged to be supplying minors with what, again, very subjectively is deemed to be inappropriate material. And we have to just talk about this for a second, because how often do you hear critics on the right call out so-called cancel culture, right? And they cry censorship when someone is taken off Facebook or when they otherwise face consequences in the commercial realm for some statements that they made. Now, to be clear, facing consequences from businesses or getting booted for violating terms of service on Twitter is not censorship. Now, the government passing laws about what teachers and librarians can say, that literally is censorship. So I just, you know, have to call out that sort of double standard here. And, you know, it's something we've talked about on this show, the political movement that's sort of motivating these book bans. And it's something that TLA President-elect Mary Woodward called out in her statement that announced this new initiative in Texas. She said that, you know, proponents of banning books claim to have children's best interests at heart, but it's clear that this is really about winning votes at the ballot box. I think that's absolutely right. And TLA President Dan Burgard also noted the danger in the statement. He said that, you know, the implication by government officials that librarians and teachers are out there intentionally selecting books that they know are harmful to students, well, that narrative undermines libraries and teachers' best efforts, and it erodes public trust. You know, and this has come at a time when librarians are being constrained in many ways in their ability to choose books. But when that happens, Burgard points out, it's the students who suffer. Burgard said that libraries must remain places for voluntary inquiry. And he added that, and I like this line from him, that no one book is right for everyone, but one book can make a significant difference in one life.
And finally, one last note on libraries. CCC podcast listeners will hear on Monday from Nick Poole of the UK about Ukrainian libraries that are offering resources for resistance in their country.
Yeah, I'm so delighted that you have that. I mean, it's a really interesting story, right? And I've seen it in other media as well. There's this post going around about Ukrainian libraries offering resources and resistance in their country. It's like shelter, right? And camouflage and books. And of course, information and books are very important. They really are an important weapon in this war. And it just brings me to, you know, we have to talk about, too, what we're seeing going on in Russia, right? We're seeing more and more stories in the media about how the people in Russia don't believe what their country is doing to their brothers and sisters in Ukraine. You know, they're believing the disinformation in Russia. And I say this in all seriousness. It may sound a little, you know, out of bounds, but I believe it to be true that it is a slippery slope from the kind of legislation that we're seeing being proposed in some states right now in America, telling teachers what they can and cannot teach, and major media orgs undermining our elections, for example. It's a slippery slope to this Russia-like situation where you have a significant percentage of people who don't believe the truth, who don't trust the news when it's right there in front of them. You know, this may all seem like a political squabble now, but I think it's vitally important that we recognize what is going on in our country. And then we have to stand with our schools and libraries, right? And if that sounds political, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, the truth is not partisan. You know, it's funny. I had occasion to go back and reread some articles for an issue we're doing here at PW. And one thing I ran across was a speech that Andrew Wiley gave in Frankfurt in 2017, where he talked about the importance of diverse books. And I was really struck by his words against everything that was happening in the news. And I'll read a little of that for you here. I printed them out. Andrew Wiley says that, "I think autocrats and autocratic societies are doomed to fail. Why? Because the desire politically to enforce a single view of the world is inevitably destined to run afoul of the fact that a diversity of views is what we have." And he went on to say that people want more. They want to travel locally and globally. They want to encounter different perspectives because that's just the way the world is. That is the human condition. And I think that observation should be heeded. I think it should be heeded in Ukraine, where Russia is seeking to impose that single view with tanks and bombs, but here in the U.S. too, where our libraries and schools are under assault at the ballot box.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks very much for joining me.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, in an essay for the Scotsman newspaper, Nick Poole, CEO of CILIP, the UK Library and Information Association, shared a series of moving exchanges with Ukrainian librarians. His besieged colleague, says Poole, fear attacks on libraries not only for the damage done to books and buildings, but also because the intention is to erase Ukrainian culture, literature, and language. Nick Poole tells me that librarians in Ukraine have responded to the war by remaking their facilities in many ways.
We've seen public libraries that have turned into shelters, including some of the cities that are being shelled. We've seen photographs of libraries running, you know, children's sessions, activities, play sessions for very small children in really challenging circumstances. We've seen libraries providing medical information, helping people to get online. We've seen quite a few maintaining communications infrastructure so that people can contact friends and family. And we've seen a whole part of the Ukrainian library community mobilize to combat disinformation. So there's obviously a lot of state-sponsored fake news and disinformation flying around. They're there right in the middle of it all, helping people tell fact from fiction.
Ukraine's libraries fight back, coming on the next CCC podcast. Our producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts, and please do follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening. Join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.